Welcome to the Why Isn't It Working? Business and Tech Podcast, talking all things business and tech in the emerging and enterprise space. Here are your hosts, Carl Wood and Michael Hamilton.
Hi, and welcome to the podcast. Today we have Andrew Sully from Talenza on board, and he's going to talk about IT recruitment in Australia and also from Sydney also. Hi, Andrew, how are you today?
Yeah, good, mate. Thanks for having me on board.
Absolute pleasure. And also, as usual, my partner in crime, Carl Wood. How are you today?
I'm very well, thank you, Michael. Glad to see you again.
Pleasure. Also, well, Carl, please feel free to kick off the first question to Mr. Sully.
Wonderful. Thank you, Michael. Andrew, thank you very much for joining us. Tell us a little bit about the journey from, you know, when you started, how you got into recruitment, and also, you know, the decision to branch out on your own and set up Talenza with your business partners.
It's a very big question, boys. We've got a lot of time. But I think, like, for most, there's definitely no, like, scientific way of getting into recruitment, because no one ever went to go and get a university degree or pay or get your parents to pay to have a degree and then be employed in recruitment. I think I wanted to be a policeman growing up. And then I was just as I finished uni, got told that I'd be good at sales or recruitment's an option. So fell into that. And then learned quite quickly that I was okay at it, and actually, you're quite a people-driven individual, wanted to help people, and then saw, obviously, there was a career path and development for it. So I'd started off in Bristol in the UK, which was like 2003, 2004, so a little while ago. Moved to Australia with the same business in 2007 and helped set up their Australian business. And we did lots of things. We did everything from technology, engineering, mining, oil. So as an individual, I was involved in setting up all those businesses at some degree and point. So it gave me a really bloody good understanding of Australia and what makes Australian tick, and the amount of import, export of iron ore, gold, everything to China. And actually, you know, then come back to Sydney in 2015 from Perth, I re-emerged back into tech. And then that was always the plan, really, was that I think move back from, I went from Sydney to Perth and Perth back to Sydney. And when we were moving back, was always a piece of, let's just reinvent myself back into technology into Sydney and reconnect and rebuild and see what's going on. And then was to always to own my own business. Cause I think I had, you know, worked for someone for, you know, that period of time where, you know, I wanted to do it for myself. I wanted to be able to offer things that other companies may or may not have done. Right a few wrongs, and then, yeah, we set up Talenza. So the four of us that set up Talenza, so myself, Henry, Simon, Dan, all worked together at a previous company, and still to the day, like, the business that we worked for all hired us as graduates and trained and developed us and give us opportunities that we'll never ever get without doing them. So there's never any bad blood or anything related for that business. But there was things that we saw as an industry and their business that was just, you were never going to change it. It was a global business that there was no way they were going to rewrite processes and approach at all best intentions. They were just never going to do it. So setting up Talenza was always around going, we felt that we could offer the industry something that was personable and fun and approachable, but at the same time, being able to service them, you know, large enterprise businesses at scale. But having a personalized approach. And that's why from the off, we'd always measured like customer satisfaction, which is something because our industry's wrought with, you know, some bad behaviors, which, you know, I don't know, well, you've never been a recruiter, but you turn up to barbecues off the back of, like, you know, mum and dad's groups having kids and stuff. And they say, oh, where are you from? What do you do? Like, I'm in recruitment. And their eyes just roll. And they're like, you know, because everyone's had some horrendous experience, and you're like, oh, please don't tarnish me with that brush. And so that's kind of the things that we wanted to kind of write, and that's where putting our money where the mouth was, which was, look, we're telling you their service is open, transparent, we're more customer centric, and the only way you can do that is by measuring that kind of result. So that's what we did from the off. We were very transparent with our contractor rates, margins that we were charging, measured customer satisfaction, which I think is like very much keep it simple, stupid, but there's things that our industry have never done. And then we, within 3 years, grew to 30 million revenue, 32 staff, and then COVID hit. So it's been an interesting 8-9 months, but we were always set up to survive cash positive, had a good recurring revenue stream of contracts and have some good client base. And I think if you do the right thing by clients, they stick with us and they've helped us through it as well. And we'll come out the other side stronger, I think.
Excellent. That's great to hear. And obviously the challenges of COVID, I guess, you know, especially around March, April, there was a lot of uncertainty. Have you found now with the government stimulus packages that that's sort of started to settle down a bit and people are returning to posting job ads and reaching out to you guys to fill those positions?
Yeah, and they never, so it definitely stopped. Like it was someone just turned the music off. and I keep referring to that as like musical chairs, because whatever you were left holding when the music stopped, that's kind of what you had to play with. So what client relationships you had, what the level of relationship you might have had with certain clients and where you were with any kind of tender processes, that's what you had to kind of like survive off for when the music kind of finished. And I think for many, they were in a bad position. So if you had leveraged your business all around travel, then, you know, you definitely got hurt. But in terms of stimulus packages, yeah, I mean, it came out quite quick. It did seem a long wait, and it was a waiting game for many, but clients were still calling in requirements. Like, you know, think the emerging tech places or clients that were able to pivot quickly, you know, were automating processes and systems, you know, all of a sudden project. I remember I got a call from a guy in government and went, Sully, I've been quite happily for the last 9 months, just tricking along, being like number 40 on a project list. And I've just been told I've got to get it to number one. So I think a fair few people were just, you know, all of a sudden pushed and got the inject button to, you know, advance their projects, which then drove bigger hiring around the engineering, DevOps, integration, those types of skills, and which is even today absolutely mad. Because you've got candidates that have like 4 or 5 offers within a week. It's almost like the mining boom. Like people weren't even interviewing in mining and they were just getting offers. It's going a little bit crazy. And there was already a shortage of people before COVID. But I do feel the government have handled it, you know, as best as they could. It's something they've never actually handled before. Maybe side kind of point, a personal view is, I don't think we've had the true economic downturn because of the stimulus packages. And so having the JobKeeper, you know, we didn't need it. Like, you know, we needed it and had it, but it's one of those things like, could we have survived without it? Could many of others survive without it? And actually, you know, with JobKeeper, you know, you haven't had as many insolvencies and that type of stuff. And if they didn't actually if they just maybe rolled it out for the first couple of months and then from like 1st of July removed it, you would kind of probably see our economic economy in a better position.
No, definitely. Look, it's been a contentious issue and conversation for many people actually at the moment, that JobKeeper system. But from your point of view in the last, even pre-COVID, how many, what sort of industries were dominating your books at the moment?
We started in Sydney. So Sydney's obviously a predominantly banking and financial services led kind of hub. And even off the back of that, then you get many fintechs. So predominantly, I would have said percentage wise, we would have been 70, 75% banking and financial services, but we had always made a conscious effort to make sure we were developing our commerce industries. I joke to my business partners now, because in the last downturn of GFC, I didn't have a gambling company as part of my portfolio. And I was always like jealous of friends because they had those clients because they grew. And so we'd worked really hard to develop kind of, you know, patches in those spaces. And obviously realized within a, you know, a pandemic and a COVID, they're not untouchable like they were in the GFC. So we're across most industries. I think that's the only way you can really probably scale a recruitment business in the Australian market, is to cover all industries. Whereas if you ever speak to a recruitment owner in Germany, America or UK, Asia, they might just purely be banking, and there might just be front office banking tech, or there'll be pharmaceuticals and they will just stick to that and that will be their thread. But that's where you find in Australia, there's, I think it's like 86% of recruitment businesses are less than 10 heads, or they were pre-COVID, and there's probably those companies are down to like the 2s, the 4s, I would have thought now. But it's it's not a huge economy here. So it's just about being able to offer a really good service across multiple industries. And obviously our thread to that is around technology and transformation space.
So obviously there's the component of, you know, specializing in certain areas. So with Talenza, obviously you guys look at, you know, technology, finance. But I mean, surely there are some, you know, predispositions to what makes a good candidate, irrespective of the industry as well.
Yeah, well, that even so, before GFC, you would, and you boys maybe remember this, there was clients that if they were in banking, they were like, well, I wouldn't take, if someone was an engineer from Woolies, they wouldn't employ them. Or it'd be quite hard to convince the banking client to take it, or vice versa. It was always that commerce people were trying to get into that front office banking tech space. But I think as the technology has become probably more understood and more prevalent to a business and actually seen as more of a valuable asset, then really it's come down to actually the skill set these days. And that's been, you know, maybe for the last, you know, eight or probably post GFC, that kind of attitude for many businesses has changed. So I think as long as you're capable in your tech stack and you know what you're doing and you're a large enterprise and you've done, you know, things at scale and you understand agile at scale and all the rest of it, then businesses are more open then to the individual and the skills. Whereas I think, you know, post or pre GSD days, that was kind of like always hard to convince clients, go, no, he's done what you're asking.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, because I guess now with the digitization of services, that's a very good point. Before, if people didn't have financial experience, they wouldn't even be considered, you know, irrespective if it was a developer job or front of house, whatever it might be. You literally had to have a foot in the door in that industry before you even applied for the job, so to speak, as well.
Well, I think maybe it might have related maybe closer to that investment banking kind of space, which really doesn't exist so much or is not as prevalent these days because it all went back to Asia and the US. But that was always the pinnacle because they always paid the most money. And it was that we were, you know, maybe they didn't say it like this, but they felt that they were that, you know, tier above. And that's where then it was kind of the emergence, wasn't it, post GFC, like the retail banking, the growth and the acquisition of all the talented people, because the likes of CBA and Westpac did struggle to get some of the best tech talent, because the tech talent was always the top of the tree, or to say the what you perceive to be the strongest candidates all went to the investment banks, right?
Very much so. And what do you see at the moment? Is there a bit of a growth period in contracts, or are you seeing a growth in permanent demand? What's happening from the COVID situation?
So I'd was quite calmly and said to my business partners, because they're a few years younger or hadn't been in the recruitment as long as me, so this was their first downturn. I was like, we don't have to worry. What will happen is contract will just, you know, have this aggressive curve line where people will, you know, they'll won't be as reliant on permanent staff. But that kind of really hasn't happened. Like, I haven't seen the same trends. Like, and then you, because you would speak to people then that, you know, been in their third downturn, you know, people like, there's a guy called Greg Savage, if you ever heard of him, he's like, you know, the whole like legend dinosaur in recruitment, has been through every downturn possible. And he would have always said there'll be a big contract resurgence, which has always been the case in every downturn. I think that's starting to come as budgets have been released. But certainly from April to today, it's been more like 50-50. And if anything, clients have almost kind of leaned into going, well, and this is where a little bit, you kind of have to, you know, you bite your tongue and hold your breath a little bit, because clients say, well, you know, unemployment's up and, you know, we're going to take advantage and secure people essentially on permanent versus contract. We're going to get rid of contractors and place them with permanent people. But you're like, you're having that conversation with people and you're like, you're hiring engineers. You're hiring people that don't exist. Like, you're asking for people that are in demand still. Like, if you're in travel and you want a flight attendant, then definitely, you know, probably offer them less than they were before COVID. So you have to have some of these conversations with clients. But I think, like in any downturn, there's opportunities for businesses to reduce costs. So if you can get rid of your reliance in certain projects on contractors and then find some permanent people, a downturn, whether you're a contractor or a permanent person, does kind of, you know, play on the mindset of security, you know, over cash for some people. So we have seen contractors say, you know, I'm happy to take that permanent job, which you guys all know that that person, as soon as the market picks up and someone offers them 1500 a day again, they'll be off. But so I've seen, we've seen more clients lean into, well, let's take a bit of a longer term approach and try and build up that capability. So they're coming at it from a business angle, but then there really is the cost benefit of that. But obviously they're trying to say to the market, they're trying to build, I think, those in-house capabilities and not be reliant on contractors. But I would start to see in typically October, November, every year, no matter what the type of market, more project budgets get released. People are more aware of what needs to be delivered. And that's where the contract kind of uptake will happen, which we're starting to see probably this month.
In addition to that, do you think when people talk about sort of, I guess, the skill shortage, is that more because we're playing in a smaller market? So you're seeing a lot of the same repeat candidates come up? Or is there a bit more to it? Is it sort of something you see starting from younger generations, you know, through university? Because we've had some very interesting guests on board in the recruiting space who said, oh, there is a small talent pool, but in addition, a lot of the younger guys with less experience also aren't being given that opportunity to kind of jump up into those roles as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's always the case. Every, you know, you've obviously got growth in the SME market, startup market, you know, you've got B2B payments, fintechs kicking off. And, you know, I think this week I've already been pitched three of them that I didn't know existed. So you've got more SMEs spinning up because there seems to be, you know, I think the VC groups here are growing. There's more cash to invest in Australian startups. I think the likes of the Atlassians and Canvas have really put Australian technology on the map. And so you've got these bigger VC groups coming in, raising capital, further investment. So you've got more startups. But as a startup, they need, you know, they want someone with eight hands, you know, two brains and, you know, to do a job of three people. So they don't offer that. A large portion of them don't offer the flexibility to bring some of these younger guys and girls in. And then also in the bigger companies, there are good grad schemes like the Westpac, Macquarie Banks have some amazing grad schemes, but then I don't think they probably have, their uptake is not as big as it maybe could be or should be. So it is an area that could be addressed and needs to be addressed. And I think if you're, you know, any business owner right now, if you could take the opportunity to grab some of the best grads and offer them opportunities, they'll have their pick because there's not as many jobs that people are willing to take the punt, I guess, because they just see it as a training development, you know, time. People, I don't have time to train that person. Everyone, I think as life's going on, people just think they have not as much time. So I do think some people are just a bit ignorant. They forget that they were once a grad and, you know, someone spent the time with them.
It's funny leading into that is the university system. Do you believe it at the moment from an IT perspective, they're well prepared or they've got enough skill sets, or do they need to bolt on things on top once they do finish? What do you find?
I've done a fair bit of work over time at universities and sponsor one of the events for the UTS, but the universities could definitely do more. And I do, like, this is every large enterprise has a grad program and they all have they have someone in HR that deals with the grad program and someone's a program manager that deals with that. But I do feel, I reckon it is an opportunity that universities could be more proactive or even just changing up the degrees, because like, why isn't a software engineer being forced? So in the mining and oil industry, if we take them, you can just do a geology degree and not spend any time as an intern or you know, an employee for 6 months and get a job. But the people that get the best jobs at the Woodside, Chevron's, those sort of companies, have all taken the extra year out to go and do a full intern to understand the life cycle of business. So I really think that universities could be more proactive with setting people up for the future, because if you've had a year working at Westpac or, you know, those types of secondments as part of your, you know, passing your degree, it would make them more marketable. Then also that, you know, it's those things then are leaned into the individual, so they're told that they can reach out to offer and get those internships. But I mean, how many like 19, 20-year-olds are being that proactive, you know, these days to reach out. They don't even know how to communicate these days. They said probably send an email, say, well, I've done that. And if no one replies to them, they're not really following up because they're not, you know, driven with initiatives, you know.
It's funny, the last couple of podcasts we've had, we've discussed soft skills quite regularly and leading into obviously new people coming into the workforce, engineers. Are you finding that the soft skills are what your clients are asking for more often than not to improve? Or what is the thing that stands out?
Career for us to be asked to go and find, you know, someone 1-2 years experience. It's not been our like wheelhouse. It's not been what our attachment to our business has been. But we've had one recently, and it is probably in the last, in the 3 years we've been set up, it is probably maybe only like half a dozen. And it does come down to the person, right? Their willingness, their initiative, their how they've gone and researched into something, their proactiveness, and then probably their self-awareness, emotional intelligence, which, you know, yeah, many of grads would apply for those jobs. And you know that they're just, I don't know, it's upbringing, it's who they are. They haven't been put in the real world. The one thing you'll find as a difference in Australia, like in, you know, UK and the US, when you go to university there, a large portion leave home and then go and live, you know, like 3 hours, 4 hours, 5 hours away from mummy and daddy. And so those life lessons from the early age, you know, as an individual, you don't know you're going to be getting those life lessons. But in Australia, just the way that, you know, the scale, the size of the country, how it is, you don't leave home. And you've got people that are, you know, probably getting their first or even second job, 24, 25, 26, and they're still at home with mummy and daddy doing their washing for them. So just as a, you know, I personally think they're the type of things that would hold back some of these kind of graduates because they're not having to fend for themselves. They're not having to make a decision, you know, do I spend the extra money on a beer or do I turn up to the lecture, you know? And you just, you have to be forced to make decisions, whether they're like life-changing decisions or not, but living away from home. So Australia's always going to have, I think, that kind of against them. It's nothing wrong or nothing right with it. But I do feel as then as a country, what do you do to kind of circumvent that? So if graduates aren't going to be living away from home, because that's where it is, you go to university that's an hour's drive, half an hour's drive from your home, how do you instill and drive initiative, decision-making skills? You do have to change something to do with the, you know, the process of going through a degree. It's not just about learning and, you know, and articulating a message in an essay or passing a test. There's got to be more to it. I've always thought it, I hated degree, I hated it. I was like, well, I've got to go and spend bloody 20 hours this week in a library reading these books to tell you something you already know. Okay, good. That I'm never going to use again. Thanks very much. What a waste of time. But if I didn't do it and I never submitted that degree, I would never have got my job because I would never have shown the aptitude to learn and articulate a story or a message, right? So you need to do it. But it's just there's nothing better than going in a workplace and having a job. And following rules, processes, how things are put together, you know?
That's a good point. And look, obviously on that note, what are you finding is the required skill sets that your clients are asking for? Is it like DevOps, security, data?
I mean, that's... You can't do a digital project without probably having data. And then you can't... All the things that put together, like, you know, if you're going to digitize your business and have a better customer journey and a better customer voice, then it all starts with your data. And then it's like, actually, that's why a lot of businesses I feel still today are struggling because, you know, some of the larger businesses in Australia are all through M&A and acquisition and never really been pulled together. So you can never, you probably got, you know, duplicates of information. They don't know where the information is, where it's stored. And that's why I think, you know, the likes of ANZ are building a new bank because it's just start from scratch almost. You know, it's easier to start over again than actually pull all the information from about 20 different businesses that have been pulled together for 100 years. So everything from integration, DevOps, engineering, they're probably the most voluminous in demand. And then it's good bloody leaders that can communicate and influence.
And with that in mind, obviously with data, are you finding that going back to university kind of conversation with education, are you finding at the moment there's enough educational staff or people on the market to support the requirements that are coming from now into the future?
classic because everyone seems to love like the data scientists, and it seems to be almost too many of them. Everyone wants to be a data scientist. Everyone wants to be exploring. It's very theorist based. I think it plays quite, not to undermine data science by any means, but it's quite an easier step from uni to that job, because to be a data scientist, you know, you need to be obviously good with the mathematics, but researching and pulling data, it's a very easier step into that world of doing the job, I find. So the data skills, fine. Data engineers is a shortage, because there's not really as far as I'm aware, there's not really a degree for data engineers. You're either a software engineer who's passionate for data or gets the back end. I don't think we have as much of a challenge to find good data people as that we would to find good full stack engineers. And we did have one client at the minute of a React front end developer, but was really good with Java. And I was like, that's not gonna really, if someone's doing React, they don't like Java. They don't want to play with the back end, but you get those kind of requirements.
What makes a good sort of, I guess, relationship between you and the client when you're sort of scoping out a JD? Like, you know, how do you like to sort of, you know, work with a client to create the best profile in order to fulfill that job with the best person?
Well, this is what personally for me, I've always tried to, it's convincing the client to give you more time. That's always where it starts. And this is, this is not giving any other recruiter any kind of secret tip or not. It's just whether they want to be able to do it or can actually do it to that effect. But this goes back to even a point where so many clients had such a bad experience that their perception of recruiters is a shit and they don't understand what they're talking about. But then, so what happens there is the client doesn't give the recruiter the best possible chance to be successful, which is feeding them with all the information. Or maybe they've done that before and the person still didn't get it, you know? So you need to, as a recruiter, be able to ask the questions, the right questions. And it's not just taking the first answer as gospel, right? It's like, what do you mean by that? Can you explain that? What does that mean? So I think always with a client for me, if starting off, even if it's a client that is, you've placed 100 project managers with, we'd always take them back to the start of the process and say, I know what you're looking for, but let's just go back to the root course, because from one project manager or one engineer to the next, there's got to be some nuances that you might find on this project, the way your business has matured, that, you know, is not in that job spec. You know, what's the culture like? Who's the management? What's the stakeholders? You've got to go from like a real end to end. So for me, I think it's always about understanding, driving that need of the individual. What does success look like for that person? Because if we're able to articulate that entire story to an individual, it's one way that we can influence people, you know, leaving a job that they're happy with, and being able to articulate the right message. So it's convincing the client that together you're like a joint venture. So whoever you're working with, it's like, I am representing your brand. So the more information that you can give me, the better that I'm going to represent your brand. And I think overall, our industry, this has been my educational piece always, when even we hire people or people that work for me over time, this is your key differentiator. And you would think that most recruiters do this, but they don't. And, you know, because a client is talking to you, many people would go, well, I don't want to say to the client, you know, I don't want to ask this question because I'll be awkward. The client doesn't give them enough information and then they don't service them well. And then you basically get that continuation of, well, recruitment industry shit. purely because as a recruiter, you know, there's a younger workforce. Now I've got a bit more gray hair now, so I'm happy to like stand up for myself. But if you're like a 25-year-old guy or girl talking to a 40-year-old, 50-year-old manager, you know, you're probably more often not gonna not stop and feel comfortable saying, sorry, I don't understand what you mean by that. Can you explain further? And it's really simple, but actually, if you haven't got that experience, you're not. And then you lead and it continues.
Sort of get trapped in a web of your own BS, I guess, where you're off running and chasing your tail. One of the interesting things was, Andrew, we had Robin from MBN from Scotland, who said that it's bipartisan, where, yes, there are some dodgy practices in recruiting where people aren't sort of asking the right questions or trying to make a quick buck. But he said, well, that's also facilitated by clients not giving enough attention or enough, you know, detail and sort of, you know, investment into the recruitment process itself? Are they sort of get lazy and outsource it? Do you agree with that?
Not for overall, but for one manager to another manager, definitely. And this is where it goes back to, if you've had a bad experience, you just think less of the recruitment industry. And so then you're less likely to give them investment. And you have to educate a client what it takes to find people. They just think there's an endless amount of people on your books, or you should know the best people. And you're like, well, it's a timing. I do know some really great people, but what if they're not interested in your job? What if they're not looking? I've got to go and find new people constantly. It's like people have moved. This is like, it never ends. So you've got thousands of people in your network, but it's just the timing. And then the more information they can give you, the better. But I do feel that there is many managers or businesses that have a certain view of recruitment. And so they don't give the full investment. And it's like, well, sod it, just send it to those 10 people and we'll get someone eventually. And they're the ones that will struggle the most to retain people typically, as well as attract them. The companies that spend the time that actually could be a technology business and you've got a technology product, but you are built on people. So as soon as you get those really good HR folk that know and really understand about retaining and attracting staff and building the right cultures, they're the ones that go, do you know what? I'm going to work with the best people because I want to absolutely invest so that you're just as emotionally and attached to my business as I am to you. And so it takes a while, but you know, you've got to just build those relationships and prove yourself.
The other thing we asked a couple of the guys last week was, you know, a lot of the recruitment, obviously from yourself, you're an import, you know, to Australia. A lot of the space is dominated by people from overseas. Do you have any sort of theories about why that's the case?
Recruitment is not an easy job for many people's like beliefs against it. And I've got a good mate, Aussie, who will always like, oh, what are you doing today, Sally? You on LinkedIn again? You just like sending emails all day. He just completely belittles it. And he's actually, you know, it's like no truer than a word spoken. Like he actually means it, but he is taking the piss at the same point. But two things on it. One, it is a harder job, and it's a very much about, reward and recognition. So the more you put in, the more you get. And so for a fair amount of the industry that, for the Brits, up till obviously till they've changed the visa laws, one of the easiest industries to get into as a British person is in recruitment, to get sponsored. So a route to becoming a PR or citizen historically was recruitment for a fair amount of younger Brits that were coming in. So you had to just like it or lump it. Whereas the Australians, if they didn't like it, they could go and get another job. So, you know, from a base salary entry in recruitment, you could probably go and run a pub, and that's quite fun. With failing every day in recruitment and dealing with rejection as a 21-year-old, 25-year-old is not fun, right? So you had those kind of like, as an Aussie, you could quite easily pick up and go and get a fairly paid good salary in another job. And a Brit didn't have that opportunity until they get their PR as a citizenship. Then the other piece on it is when I've dealt with a lot of the universities to promote recruitment to try and, what my old business used to hire graduates. So try and get the people that were like, before they've even started thinking about it, go and approach them, do presentations and educate them on recruitment. And it was really funny when you went and spoke to some of these like heads of business or heads of HRs and all the rest of it at the universities, how they positioned recruitment was the people that were uneducated and no degrees. So in the HR degree in Australia, the recruitment person is someone who didn't finish their degree, and it basically always someone who just hires the blue collar people. And they don't believe that the white collar recruitment market, there's an earning or career potential in it. So that is how they were sold it at university. Whereas in the UK university, it's seen as a job as like, it's a really good industry. It's actually well-paid industry. There's a really good progression in there. And it was almost like if you weren't smart enough to become like a trader, you become a recruiter. So just in those two different countries is a very different view of what is taught from an educational perspective as well. So there is what, so that, that's my two views.
It's funny because there's a real go and get it, you know, go get a behavior with the recruitment industry, particularly the people from the UK. And it's just a good attitude to come along. But what Robin actually pointed out from Glasgow was that with the remote working and single mums and the flexible working hours of COVID, it created more opportunities and more jobs instead of having to look in the geographical cities like Sydney or Melbourne. Are you finding the same? Are the employers now branching out and allowing a greater catchment area for jobs?
No, this is like, funny. I got talked in to do another conference, and the journalist who was preparing for the panel was like, right, so the reason that we've got you in is because you're going to come with all these facts and figures to tell us how remote the world's becoming and clients are really leaning into this and hiring and flexible. And I was like, I'm sorry, but I'm not sure who told you that, but I have no statistics to give you that at all. We've got not one, I think we've had maybe one that's gone, oh, I might be open to Melbourne or Sydney. But the not, and I'm, you know, maybe this is just the clients that we're dealing with. But we haven't had one client that has said, yeah, I'm more than happy to hire that engineer in Adelaide for a job that was historically in Sydney, or I'm happy. Now, in terms of remote work, this is where the question was like, well, if you're working remote, if you're hiring a contractor for 6 months and you're remote for the next 6 months and everybody, you're not allowed in the office, then why wouldn't you hire an engineer that's in Darwin? And they're like, oh, but we, if we like them, you know, we want to hire them and maybe they'll start in Sydney one day. So there's definitely not been an uptake. Now, my theory on that is we're not post-pandemic. So I don't think people really understand what post-world looks. What they've done is everyone worked remote because that's the bestest, safest thing for individuals in the country. But they're actually probably leaning into the, what does the world look like, you know, maybe in the new year, January, February? Because don't make a business decision where you say that we're going to be remote first over office first, and don't say hire that person, you know, that lives in Wagga Wagga that they can live and work remotely full time, because we don't know if that's going to be the case in the new year. So I'm kind of, that's my like empathetic view of it. But I do think humans like to spend time with other humans, and there's a big part of the workforce that will just revert to norm, which is they'll be going into the office more and more. There's a big financial services client in Sydney, which I won't mention the name. They were very theoretical around admin tasks will stay in office and all other jobs can stay fully remote. We're going to lean into it. And they put that message out in the market. And they have actually changed that message in the last month and said, actually, it doesn't work. Our you know, front office, our sales teams, our agile teams aren't being as productive as they were when they're in the office. So we want them to actually come back in the office. And they're being suggested to be in the office more, not told, but suggested, which we've probably in the last couple of weeks could list half a dozen clients that have taken that mantra of like, well, how many days are you willing to come back in the office now then? So I think a lot of chatter around this full remote work and, you know, a complete change in the industry. I just think there's just going to be, it definitely changes the work-life balance. I think some people reflection of, oh my God, why was I in the, don't need to be in the city 5 days a week. And I also think that the biggest win is for the engineers. They're like, yeah, I get on a train for 2 hours or whatever and I don't talk to anyone all day. And I'm just on, you know, Confluence and I can do all those things no matter where. So I think there's a big portion of the tech community that have won the battle. And even my own wife was asking to work one day from home and she got told that she couldn't because she was part-time and part-time people aren't allowed to work from home. But then in the world that we're in now, they're like, oh yeah, whatever you want.
That's interesting from that point of view, because obviously leading into the more the employer's requirements for IT, I know we discuss a lot around efficiencies and speed of DevOps, for example, and then the cost reduction side of IT. What are you finding are the demands? What demands you find for projects when you're finding candidates?
So an aspect of, from a business owner perspective, what?
Yeah, outcomes, yeah. Is it more efficiency or cost reduction, depending on their IT strategy? What do you find?
I think they want both is probably the majority of the answer to that. At the start of this, when you spoke to like some senior leaders that maybe a bit more outspoken than others, they were like, well, never let a crisis get in the way of opportunity, which was what costs can we strip out? And that's why many businesses, like, you know, got rid of offices, leaned into this remote world, because why be paying for leases and all the rest of it and squeeze on these things? But then from definitely hiring the uptake on engineers and some of these SMEs that have sprung out of probably the pandemic, because they've like expedited some of their projects and actually have increased in sales, like, you know, Zoom's like, you know, the one that everyone talks about, right? Is that is actually through business opportunity, right? So it might help reduce costs, but also it's going to increase revenue as well. So I think, yeah, there's no reason. There were some clients that purely went into this with cost reduction exercise. It all starts with cost reduction, and, you know, and then I think for the other half, it will be for revenue generation. It just depends on horses for courses, right? Well, what is your business and how has it been impacted? And actually, what's the benefit to you longer term that you can take advantage of in a down period that actually you're not going to get put in the news report in the front of the Guardian, or, you know, you're not going to be on the Daily Mail because you've done something wrong.
Totally. And the reason why I asked the question too was obviously there's the enterprise employment, okay, and keeps a large amount of the economy moving. But then you mentioned the fintechs that you do hire a lot of people for or place people into. So all that, are you seeing that increase in investment in fintech picking up the slack for the things that do for, you know, churn that does go out of the enterprise area?
It's frustrating. Where people are, you know, trying to take advantage, saying, oh, the unemployment rate is high and it's so easier to find people. It's not easy, especially when you're hiring engineers, because there has been greater demand. You've got so many of the payments fintech companies that are increasing, that have gone to market and raised capital. You know, there's probably so many people lined up to list their businesses, you know, this year, because also they've taken the benefit of a JobKeeper. So they've had more money to spend. So actually they've taken JobKeeper because they could, because they're a startup and they've been impacted and they're under a certain revenue. So they've been able to benefit from it and then use that capital to reinvest. So that's what it's been. Australia, like, is always, it come through the GFC pretty strong, didn't it? You know, made a big call on shutting the borders for this, but, you know, as an economy, they will be better than many others, right?
Do you see Australia can improve with its investment in innovation? Obviously, you do hire people and put people into fintech. Do you think it should be on the increase, or is there a lot going on, you feel, at the moment?
No. Well, when you compare Australia's innovation markets and investments, you're going to be like per capita or that type of stuff versus the US, UK's, it doesn't really come that close, right? And it's funny, isn't it? You learn when you've been in the country, well, I've been here, 13 years now, it's monopolized by big companies, four big banks, you know, two big telco, four insurers. There's monopoly across most industries. And rightly or wrongly, people know that they can set up a business and sell it to one of those. So, like, you know, when you're setting up a business, people always, the first thing they say to you, if you go to any like VC or investors, like, who's your buyer? You know, there's definitely an uptake on more companies listing, but they will list as a first port of call to sell then, maybe to get wealth out of it. But that's the one thing I find in Australia, more so than not, a setting up to sell to one of those companies. There's obviously that, like, companies like 86400 have definitely not come here. Well, they haven't come here to sell to one of them. They've come to disrupt, which is brilliant. But how many more of those have said that? You know, everyone else is, you know, they won't say it because they don't want to say it. But really, they're just getting to a certain point where one of the big boys goes. So I do think there's a lack of probably real innovation, but there is innovation there, but it doesn't get to a scale that really then disrupts the likes of like Canva and Atlassian are like really like market leaders, or even SiteMinder. You know, people forget about those guys as well, but there's not many of them that stand the true test of time and stand on their own two feet forever.
And we found a lot of those have obviously then, you know, set up headquarters overseas because of restrictions within Australia anyway, right? So it's kind of a launching pad into the next location.
Yeah. And yeah, well, yeah, tax. Yeah. Tax is pretty hefty, yeah. But go and set up a business in Singapore, It's, you know, cheaper to find people, less tax. You're always going to then cause the innovation to go offshore, right? They released the other day, or they, I think it's not through yet, but Gladys for New South Wales, if you hire 30 staff, you don't have to pay payroll tax for the next 4 years. So that's actually quite a good SME tool, that if you're going to grow, that's a good reinvestment. So I would love to see more of those things. That shouldn't be like, but you know, a pandemic or a downturn does force some more creative thinking to stimulate the economy. And there is things like that that will help, you know, all industries reinvest that money to grow, and you know, whether it's technology or people, whatever it is. There are like some good little initiatives that have come up in the last week or two. Sorry, mate, your question.
No, it's exactly on that mode. Like Talenta's grown massively in the last couple of years, and there is massive growth in the market for new businesses and so forth. But how do you find, what does the future look like for you guys now, looking at enterprise spend post-COVID, you know, innovation that comes onto the market?
What we're trying, like for us, is to hold in a position where we are, probably hire a couple of people for the end of financial year. Like our Brisbane business, it's been flying, it's been really successful. Like, I think it's more around maybe attitudes in the region, but also then as a state, it was probably the least effective as one of the larger economies in Australia. So it's kind of had that kind of, you know, less disrupted kind of run up, I think, this financial year. But this financial year, I think, hold tight, grow a few heads, and it will just, you know, I think like last month was like 1.5% growth on the month before. So there's growth there. It's just trickling along, and that will, I think, stay steady. And obviously we've got the JobKeeper that finishes like end of February. So we'll be interested to see what happens to the economy there. But then for us, we had rolled out in January, the start of this year, that we, like as a business, we want to like dominate in the space that we're in, and we want to grow. The plan was to always be in Sydney. We had actually planned to open Melbourne in August the 1st this year, but in April we kind of ripped up those plans because that was never going to happen. But our three-year plan, our three-year plan that we rolled out in January, was to be 55 sales heads, so roughly about 60 staff across the technology transformation space in Sydney, Brisbane, Melbourne markets. I think that kind of plan will kick back off the start of the next new financial year. So I think for most people, it's like get through this financial year, hold tight, keep strong cash position, just do what you can to maintain, get the other side of things, and then go again.
Well, it's good, mate. It's good. You've done very well this year. Everyone's been a hard year. We all know that, and especially for recruitment businesses. But, mate, I wish you all the best. No, but we'll make sure to put all the details. Sorry.
I said I appreciate you getting me involved in it.
No, pleasure. Absolute pleasure. Mate, we'll make sure to get all your details. We'll put them onto the actual summary of the podcast and on YouTube when it goes with this. But, mate, thank you very much for being a guest today. We much appreciate it. And, let's get you back on definitely for a round table in the new year, because we are, Carl and I, are organising that around the recruitment industry. Got some good people on there, and I think you'd be well suited to give your opinion for the rest of the industry and also some international guests.
Yeah, nice. Cool. Well, boys, love it. Thanks for putting it together, and I look forward to seeing you at the end.
No worries. And thanks a lot, Andrew, for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.